From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is Away to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
What makes a particular native plant a good choice for the home garden? And where can we look for clues into which natives will do best in our particular location and conditions? Dan Jaffe of New England Wildflower Society is here to talk about that, but first this message.
Underwriting support from Timber Press, your go-to resource for books in gardening and nature. Whether you're a new gardener, a professional at the top of your field, or a reader interested in the wonders of the natural world, their books are there to help you grow. TimberPress.com.
Dan Jaffe is propagator and stock bed grower at New England Wildflower Society, an author in collaboration with his colleague Mark Richardson of the new book Native Plants for New England Gardens. Wherever you garden, he's here to help you think about what to look for in a garden-worthy native and more. So welcome, Dan.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
Yes. I haven't been to Garden in the Woods in too long, and I'm going to come visit you soon, I promise.
Hey, we'd love to have you. Yeah. Anyone's welcome here. This place is pretty cool right now. We're a very seasonal garden, and I'd say the woodland garden really shines in spring, but right now the meadow is incredible.
I bet. So your headquarters kind of is Garden in the Woods in Framingham, Massachusetts?
That's correct. The headquarters of New England Wildflower Society is Garden in the Woods. It's a 45-acre botanical garden. You know, we've got classroom space. We've got the garden itself. We sell plants here. Our conservation offices are here.
And briefly, you then at New England Wildflower Society, you propagate plants and other things, and you teach, I think, as well, don't you?
Yeah, we're a kind of classic small organization, so mm-hmm. we all wear a lot of hats. I'm what's called the propagator and stock bed grower, which pretty much means, the majority of our propagation work is done out at Nisami Farm. It's our propagation facility. And
yes.
Think about your kind of standard propagation facility, you know, greenhouses, plants in pots, the usual routine. They probably do a good 95% of the propagation work that we do. What I do is I work in our in-ground nursery at Garden in the Woods, and I focus on either things that don't grow very well in pots or a lot of experimental species that we're not sure if we want to be growing or what we might do with them or what they can handle as far as kind of cultivation settings. It's a lot of kind of R&D sort of work. And then I also teach a lot of classes, give a lot of lectures, take a lot of pictures. You know, we all do a little bit of everything here.
Yeah. Yeah. So what I love about the new book, Native Plants for New England Gardens, that you did with Mark Richardson, in the beginning, in the introductory area, it sort of talks a little bit about what native means to you, professionals in this field. And it has a sort of a special emphasis on these ways to look for guidance from maps. And I'm a range map. I love all the range maps, but they're never quite exactly the same from source to source. So tell me, what is a native plant?
Jeez, how long is the show? We need a couple hours.
2 years.
I think that a real good honest definition is that it's a definition that has been changing as the research has advanced.
Yeah.
You know, in the past, New England Wildflower Society kind of focused on native to North America.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time, that made a lot of sense for us. And now as we've gone forward and as other native plant organizations have, you know, come about, that's not necessary anymore. And so we started focusing on New England. But we've realized, you know, quite a bit recently that plants don't really care about political lines. The idea of native to Massachusetts or native to Connecticut or native to a county is just, you know, a plant doesn't care about those things. It cares about things like rainfall patterns and underlying bedrock and soil geology and all these other factors that kind of came together to make the ecoregions. This scientist named Omericum kind of created these ecoregions, these broader kind of zones, and they're set up in different levels where you can get really, really specific to really, really broad. You know, level one ecoregions is pretty much, you know, almost continent size, and then it gets down to, I think, a level four, I believe, is the most advanced, if I'm remembering that right.
Mm.
And so these are allowing you to take a look at the nativity of a plant based on these sort of climatic and ecological zones. And it makes a lot more sense for plants. And what's kind of cool is when you start looking at the range of plants, you find that a number of them really match these ecoregions very, very well. And then if you say, look at the range of maybe a specialist, you know, pollinator of this plant whose caterpillar eats the plant, you'll find, wow, the, the pollinator's range matches the plant's range, which really follows these ecoregions really closely. You know, the evidence is there to support why this might make sense.
Right. Because even in speaking of like boundaries and so forth, so I'm in Columbia County, New York, and that sort of mid-Hudson Valley next to the Berkshires of Massachusetts. Okay. But even in my county, we have different elevations by a couple thousand feet, right? We have by alongside the Hudson River, and we have adjacent to Massachusetts, you know, hilly and rocky, mountainous. And we have, you know, we have a lot of different habitats, so to speak, or ecosystems, ecoregions, as you're saying. So even within my little county, I bet it's, you know what I mean? There's, it's not, something isn't native to every single square foot, even of a county necessarily. Correct?
Oh, of course. I mean, you've got, you know, different habitats from, you know, one site to the next. And just because something's native in, say, our ecoregion doesn't mean it's the right plant for whatever place I'm currently staring at. You know, there's, you know, don't put the dry-loving plants in the wetlands. It's just not going to work, whether it's, you know, native to the region or not.
Right.
I think a big part of it that we need to kind of think about is not just what do we mean by native, but to some extent, why do we care and how much should we care? You know, do we want our plants to all be native right to our super local site, or are we okay with a broader definition of native? And then there's the question of, you know, are we going to go get mad at someone because they've got, you know, some tomatoes and some rosemary planted on their site that don't happen to be natives, which, you know, is, I think, you know, sometimes we start kind of thinking on such a detailed scale that we kind of lose the bigger picture.
Right.
And I think being realistic about these sort of concepts is important. I personally come down on I like a nice, tight, strong definition of native, but at the same time, I don't think you necessarily need to have a 100% native landscape. Mostly because I don't think that's very realistic. As much as I would love to support a landscape that is nothing but natives, to try and remove every non-native plant from the landscape is just an effort in futility.
So these maps that we were sort of alluding to, these ecoregion maps, they're from the EPA, I think, or something. I can give a link with the transcript. Is that correct? Those are the ones you referred to in the beginning of the book, I think.
Yes, those are definitely, those are the ones.
So I'm going to turn people on to that because I didn't know about those. I know about a lot of, you know, the BONAP maps and the whatever, NPIN or whatever, you know, the different organizational range maps, but I didn't know about these. So this is kind of interesting to me. I mean, they're a different type of map.
They're extremely useful maps. I mean, we look at, we're a regional organization, so what we kind of call native as far as the book is concerned are these five ecoregions that are present in New England. And that gives us kind of a nice broad, like those are the plants that we're picking from for, say, Garden in the Woods that we want to represent, we want to show off, we want to kind of teach people about. And in many cases, those are the plants that we are recommending when people say, you know, what should I be planting, what should I keep, what should I remove, you know, that sort of stuff. That's kind of the basis for it all.
Mm. So also in the intro, you talk about how plants have migrated. So, you know, if we want to talk about this not as a, you know, physical boundary like the state of New Jersey, the state of Connecticut, the state of, you know, Alabama, but as a point in time, plants have changed over time. And I'm always fascinated when I give workshops in my garden and I'm pointing to things, you know, people are saying, what's that? And then I frequently will say where it's from or anything that I know about it. And I find that I'm pointing to a lot of things from the southeast, like here's my fothergilla, here's my Aeschylus parviflora, here's my oxydendrum sourwood tree, here's my calocarpa, here's my, you know, chionanthus fringe tree, and they're from the southeast. But maybe they weren't always just from the southeast, right? Plants migrate?
Oh, most definitely. Like one of the things we always say about defining native is you always need a qualifier. You can't just say, you know, native. It'd be, you know, to make a really stupid point, I could say that purple loosestrife is native to the planet Earth. You know, but that obviously is not a good enough reason to plant it in New England.
No.
So you need a native to, and you need a native when. So, you know, the general idea for most of New England is we look at European settlement. And
as
there's
the
good
point
reasons
in time,
for that,
right.
And kind of, you know, rough reasons for that. Yeah, as a point in time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, on the good side of things, it kind of draws a nice stark line between, you know, plants that have been moved around by natural processes or by the, you know, native first peoples versus plants that came across an ocean on a ship. You know, the great difference there. The one big thing I don't like about that is it kind of insinuates that evolution stopped the day Columbus, you know, hit this landscape,
right.
Which obviously
right.
is not, you know, the truth. Plants do migrate. They do move. And there's lots of plants that are not native here now but were very likely native here in the past. There's all sorts of cool gray zones. There's reason to believe a lot of plants are still moving north. in some cases doing it quite well, in other cases having trouble because of the fragmentation on the landscape. One of our favorite examples that always leads to a, you know, one heck of a good discussion is black locust.
Mm.
By the ecoregion definition, we can call that plant native to the New England ecoregions. And according to the state of Connecticut and I believe the state of Massachusetts, too, we could also argue that as an invasive species in New England.
Yes.
And there seems to be some pollen, you know, data out there saying that this plant was likely native throughout New England before the glaciers came and pushed it all down. So it's this wonderful gray zone that kind of shows us that we still have more to learn and we still have more to understand. And should we be defining plants as invasive on a state line? You know, we're saying it doesn't make sense for you know, native. You know, why would it make sense for invasive? Could, you know, instead should we look at ecoregions for that as well? But plants are most certainly migrating.
Yeah.
And you know, the kind of environment changes as plants move in and move out of it. And I think that's something to accept and work with.
Yeah, and you just said glaciers. And the ones that I was listing before, the Chionanthus, the Fothergillo, the Aesculus, the Oxydendrum, et cetera, for all we know, before the last ice age, their range may have been much farther north, right? I mean, that's, and I don't know, you know, I don't know the fossil history of those particularly, but, you know, I mean, once Peter Crane, the ex-head of Kew, told me that ginkgo, one of his favorite plants, once was native in South Dakota, the fossil records show.
Oh, that is cool. I haven't heard that.
It's super cool, right? So, you know what I mean?
it's very likely that, if not all, at least many of the plants you just mentioned were indeed native here. And,
yes.
And, you know, it kind of, that time again comes into effect. You know, if you want to be a real stickler and say, I want plants that, you know, were native here, you know, that have been native here the long, you know, if you go back far enough, nothing was native here except for ice and some cyanobacteria.
Right, there you go.
So maybe we should remove every plant on the landscape and call that native. You know, I think we need to be realistic and we need to kind of accept the fact that as soon as we have a definite, you know, definition, we're going to have new research and new knowledge out there that's going to, you know, force us to kind of keep educating and changing.
Yeah.
You know, science is a changing kind of passion. It's something that will evolve as time does.
Yeah.
And I think that's something important to kind of connect to.
Yeah. So the title of the book says dot, 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 you know, it's native plants for New England gardens, right? It's not just native plants like a field guide. So what qualities in a native do you look for to have it sort of make the list as garden worthy?
Yeah, we kind of had a little bit of discussion as to where to go with the book and where to go with the title, and it fell out very nicely. It just kind of naturally happened where we decided what we really wanted to focus on is plants that people could work with and plant on their landscape.
Okay.
We're not talking about restoring wild populations. We're not talking about kind of what I talk of as like traditional conservation work. We're talking about people planting plants in, to one extent or another, built landscapes. In many cases, home landscapes, but, you know, a place where we're planting. So we wanted plants, first off, that would work well in that case. You know, you'll notice there's certain species like the trillium are not represented in the book. The lady slippers are not represented in the book. We didn't want to pick plants that you really got to be a plant expert to succeed with. We wanted to, you know, first choose plants that people would succeed with. So these are good, hardworking, easy-growing, to one extent or another, kind of, you know, wide-ranging habitat needs as far as what they can handle. We also wanted to do plants that were, to some extent, the tried and true species. You know, we didn't want to have a native plant book without wild geranium or Solomon's seal in it. But we also wanted a chance to introduce people to species they may not already know about but could become tried and true species if more people got connected with them. Things like Monarda punctata, the spotted bee balm, or Euphorbia corallata, the flowering spurge, are species that I find most kind of typical gardeners have not heard of before. And these are wonderful plants that are not difficult to grow, don't need specific environments, you know, really have a lot to offer. So that definitely came into it as well. Pollinators, we wanted them to, you know, we had a thing for edibles. We wanted beautiful plants. There's this weird, you know, kind of concept out there that native plants aren't pretty. It's completely false. I mean, the funny thing is people will tell me, you know, oh, native plants aren't pretty, but I really like my bee balm. And I'll tell them, bee balm's a native plant, and all of a sudden you see the light bulb go off.
Right.
but we wanted to make sure that these are plants that you'd want to put in your garden.
I smiled because you put in some plants that when I mention them and I recommend them to people, again, at workshops and stuff like that, you know, I'll say, look, you can really improve the sort of habitat aspect of your garden if all you did was, you know, plant winterberry hollies along the perimeter. You know, give me back 8 feet along the perimeter of your property and some native viburnums and some winterberry hollies and carpet it with parthenocissus, with, you know, Virginia creeper. And they look at me and they're like, that's a horrible plant. That's a terrible plant. And I say, let grape, wild grape grow on your fence and that'll help things. And no, no, that's a horrible plant, you know, and you include those in the book. So I was vindicated.
The amount of times I've had to argue with people when they tell me goldenrods are invasive and I need to explain what invasive means, what native means, and I think the big part in plants like that is really about site choices. You know, one of the things I'm really always pushing for is no place can't be planted. And I mean, gardens are one thing. I'm not going to recommend planting, you know, the Canada goldenrod in the middle of your delicate little garden.
Right.
But if I'm going to start talking about planting highway medians and parking lot islands and abandoned lots, you know, that is not the site to put a delicate little hepatica. You know, that is the site where I want a plant that can handle being run over by an 18-wheeler, abused, you know, up the wazoo, heavy amounts of salt pollution, all that. Like, we need native plants that can take those environments. And I will take, you know, roadsides covered in vibrant yellow goldenrods any day over roadsides with Kentucky bluegrass.
Yes.
So it's really a matter of siting. I mean, one of our favorite plants are wild strawberries, which we've, you know, kind of recommended as a really good lawn alternative. And we've been working with them in garden settings, but they're a vigorous spreader. So it's really a matter of good siting. Planting it in amongst your trillium and your lady slippers and hepaticas, probably not a good idea unless you really like wild strawberries and want to get rid of all those. But if you had, say, what you were describing, winterberries and you know, witch hazels and spice bush and, you know, native azaleas and just a good shrub layer, and you want something to just cover the ground underneath, wild strawberries, Virginia creeper, you know, the Vitis labrusca, the fox grape, you know, the wild strawberry is not going to outcompete the witch hazel. So it's a matter of correct siting and choosing where to put these plants that really do kind of push on you.
Right. I wanted to ask about some other specific plants. You were mentioning some favorites, and I'm obsessed with the genus Aralia. And maybe 20 plus years ago, a native plant person from the New York Botanical Garden at the time, she gave me a couple of little seedlings of Aralia racemosa, the, I don't even know what it's called, American spikenard or something. I don't even know what if it has a generic name. Does it? A common name?
It does. I've heard spikenard. I've heard American spikenard. And I've been looking for the reason behind this. But for in a number of sources, I've seen it listed as life of man.
Oh.
And it's such an epic-sounding common name. I feel like there's got to be a good story behind it. But I've never found the story. So,
so tell us.
Spikenard's what I hear.
And that's a plant I love. And I've grown it for more than 20 years. Now, this is a perennial to beat all perennials. This is a big perennial. Dies to the ground, it's herbaceous, but every winter, but whoa, right? It's a big thing. Tell us about it.
Oh, yeah. It almost looks like a hobble bush when it's in, you know, kind of its full glory. When I see it in the wild, you know, sometimes 18, 24 inches, oftentimes more, and when you bring it into cultivation, it'll easily do 5 or 6 feet tall.
Right.
Big, broad, compound leaves, wonderful structure to it. A flower that they're starting to bloom right now. The flower isn't super showy, but the berry display that follows is phenomenal.
Yes. Phenomenal.
And quite tasty at that. It's really excellent muddled into gin and tonics. I highly recommend it.
You heard it here first, folks. A plant that's become sort of an it plant for gardeners, you know, in many regions, and albeit often a colorful leaf cultivar version of it for its ornamentality, is Physocarpus. And Physocarpus is in your Opulifolius, is in your book as well. Tell us a little bit about that as a shrub.
Right. That's nine bark. And that's one that we actually, we've been going back and forth a long time on how native is a native cultivar, should we be recommending cultivars and so forth. And I find with Physocarpus, almost always people are talking about Copertunia or Diablo or these various kind of red leaf forms. And there was, at one point, we were thinking we really ought to start just really only recommending the natural species. And then at one point we were having this just kind of brainstorming discussion, and we said, listen, we were talking about invasive species and talking about replacing invasives with good natives. And in the case of something like burning bush, it's like, which one of the 30 fabulous fall color plants do you want to recommend in its place? We eventually got to Japanese barberry and realized that what people really like about barberry is the color of the leaf. You know,
correct,
it's almost always a red leaf cultivar, and that's what people want. And it kind of led us to the you know, that kind of light bulb went off, and we said, you know what, I will take a red leaf Physocarpus, which might not have as much value on the landscape as a natural species, but I'll take that red leaf Physocarpus any day of the week over a Japanese barberry, cultivar or not. And it kind of helped us to really decide how we wanted to tackle the idea of nativars and native cultivars and things like Diablo 9 bark, which is one you can now find in our shop.
Right.
It's a great replacement for, Japanese barberry. And if you're looking for a good, red leaf plant on the landscape, I'll take a red leaf native any day over a non-native. It's a tough shrub. It can handle really difficult conditions and really can look quite nice.
Yeah, mine's been cut back, I think, to the ground 3 times in its lifetime with me, as has Dart's Gold, a big gold one. And they'll, that's the other thing. If they get too big, out of shape, out of scale, you can cut them all the way back, and I guarantee you they'll grow back again.
Oh, yeah.
So
I
that's
love a plant that you can beat up and it comes back for more.
Exactly. Another genus that I feel like I never heard about until recent years, and then suddenly it also has become sort of an it thing, is Pycnanthemum, the mountain mints. There's a number of those in the book.
And you're right to say that the genus that we haven't heard about, because I think there are 6 native New England species.
Yes.
Every single one of them is quite nice. There's probably 3 or 4 that I think are really the most garden-worthy, and kind of you name the environment, and there's a mountain mint to kind of match the site. For the moist areas, hands down, my favorite is Pycnanthemum muticum, the broadleaf mountain mint. It's got a flower that is not very showy, but it shows off quite a bit by producing these big, large, silvery bracts that, bring the pollinators in from a distance where they're then able to find that little pink flower. So though the flower may not be showy, the plant most certainly is. And it's a really, really valuable kind of, source for the amount of bee life that I see on one of these things is phenomenal. I mean, you sit there with a camera and take 20 pictures and you've got 20 different species of cuckoo bees and, mining bees and syrphid flies and, various different digger wasps and all these different kind of life forms just coming to the bloom. It works quite nicely.
Mm.
As far as dry sites are concerned, this is where it gets tougher because there's 3 or 4 different good dry species. I think my personal favorite is Pycnanthemum tenuifolium, the narrow leaf mountain mint.
Yes.
I really like the texture on that one. It's got a very thin leaf, not quite pine needle thin, but kind of maybe rosemary leaf thin. A much showier flower and a smaller bract. So, as showy as the broadleaf, but in a different sort of way. And it tolerates, just sunny, sandy, dry, very, very difficult conditions. It's one of the few plants that I think really thrives in health strips and, kind of overly sandy sites. Great species. There's a lot of good mountain mints.
So we just have a couple minutes left, and I'm going to have to invite you back for another discussion because obviously I have a million other questions to ask you. But everyone wants milkweed, so just a quick, 101. Everyone wants milkweeds, but they can be a little hard to manage. They can be tough guys. Any tips or whatever, anything that you want to tell us about? Okay, I have, Syriaca, right, is the one with the lavender sort of pink-ish hanging flowers.
I think the 101 on milkweeds is pick the right species for your spot.
Okay.
Kind of the same way we were talking about fox grape or Virginia creeper. Asclepias syriaca, the common milkweed, the meadow milkweed, is a spreader. It spreads rhizomatically. It spreads via seed. When you walk into a field and you see 30,000 milkweeds, you're likely looking at syriaca, and it's great for fields, meadows, high competition areas, sites that have been invaded. This is a plant that I think should line every sunny roadside in New England. And it's not a great choice for small garden spaces where you might want a tight clumping species. In that case, I would go for either Asclepias incarnata or Asclepias tuberosa.
Okay.
So incarnata is the one that's sometimes called swamp milkweed. I like rose milkweed. Pink flowering plant will grow in just average old garden soils, will also handle a very wet spot. Wonderful fragrance to the flowers. Can look quite a bit like syriaca at first, but has a bit of a tighter flower to it, and it's a clumping species. It barely seeds around. I wish it would more, and it doesn't spread rhizomatically. It just kind of sits there and grows bigger each year. And then Asclepias tuberosa might be my favorite species. A little bit shorter than the others, vibrant orange flowers.
Yes.
Will also grow in those average garden soils. And in an average garden soil, you could put incarnata and tuberosa right next to each other. But this one will also grow right next to that narrow leaf mountain mint in those super sunny, dry, sandy sites as well. It's a coastal sand plain species usually. So it's really a matter of picking which species you want to put where.
Right.
I wouldn't recommend syriaca for small spaces, yet I would not recommend tuberosa for, invaded sites or roadsides.
Right, right. Well, Dan Jaffe, like I said, you're going to have to come back because now you got me with my list is getting longer of questions. But thank you so much, Dan Jaffe of New England Wildflower Society, for making the time today. Good to speak to you.
Yeah, you as well. This has been fun. I'd love to come back.
Underwriting support from Timber Press, your go-to resource for books in gardening and nature. Whether you're a new gardener, a professional at the top of your field, or a reader interested in the wonders of the natural world, their books are there to help you grow. TimberPress.com.
And good to speak to all the rest of you, too. Now, don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version on Stitcher or iTunes, or find me as Away to Garden at awaytogarden.com or instagram.com or facebook.com. And happy gardening meantime.
Away to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.